If you go online when these are posted, you'll be able to click on the hyperlinks and it will take you to the pictures that you saw on the screen. And then also, there's some links on there on some suggested reading. You can click on those and it'll take you to Christian Book Distributors or some other location, and it will give you more information on the book if you want to purchase the book or get the video or whatever resource that I have on there for you. So just keep that in mind. Also, last week we were not able to cover all the notes, so if you have your notes from last week, we're just going to continue with that. Now, we covered some things. We covered the evidences that the evolutionists use to support their claim that evolution is true. We covered the ontogeny, recapitulates phylogeny. We did the gill slits, the Miller-Urey experiment, the peppered moths, the piltdown man, Nebraska man, and then we kind of touched on this a little bit last week, the geologic column. And I mentioned last week that the evolutionists will have you believe that this whole column is in place somewhere in the world, and it isn't. There are sections of it that might be there, and they just stack it on top of one another and use that as their evidence that the primitive life forms were down at the bottom. I'm getting feedback here. The primitive life forms, so-called, because that's their theory, that the primitive life forms started and then they actually grew and changed into higher life forms. But we know that's not true, but in any event, that's what they use. And so they come up with this geologic column. And some of the things I want to talk about on this one that I didn't cover last week is the fossil rock fossil conundrum. It's circular reasoning. You ask, well, how do you know how old the animals are in this thing when they find it in the stratus? How old is it? We're going to look at some reasoning that they use here. Circular reasoning. Now, the quotes that I give you, unless I tell you otherwise, these are all coming from people that believe in evolution. I will tell you when we're talking about a Christian quote, but these are their own words. And you can get these and so many more in a book. It's about this thick, and it's written by Henry Morris. It's called That Their Words May Be Used Against Them. And if you want to do some study, you don't want to buy the book, you can ask Pastor Monty if you can look at his book, because I gave him my copy to put in his library. So I'm sure that he'll let you thumb through that if you wish. But you ask, how old are the rocks and how old are the fossils? And here's what we come up with. Fossils help geologists figure out the ages of the rock strata and the times at which the animals and plants lived. So we're going to use the fossils to date how old these things are. And you come up with another quote. Scientists determine when fossils were formed by finding out the age of the rocks in which they lie. So we know how old the fossils are because of the rocks. Well, how old are the rocks? Well, we know how old the rocks are because we know how old the fossils are. So it's a big circular. Paleontology, study of fossils, is important in the study of geology. The age of the rocks may be determined by the fossils found in them. Big circular, circular reasoning. Well, you can't have it both ways. Here's Eldridge Niles. He says, and this poses something of a problem. If we date the rocks by their fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about the patterns of evolutionary change through time in the fossil record? He sees that. And then if we want to use radiometric techniques, it is obvious that radiometric techniques may not be the absolute dating methods that they claim to be. Age estimates on a given geologic stratum by different radiometric methods are often quite different, sometimes by hundreds of millions of years old. That's quite a stretch. There is no absolute reliable long-term radiological clock. We talked about the polystrate trees, the idea that you've got a tree growing up through all these millions of rock layers. Well, you can't do that. You know, if it's rock, it's rock, and you're not going to have a tree growing up through these rocks. What happened here is the tree was already there. We know about the flood and the layers of ash and so on that was laid down around the tree, and then it solidified, it became rock, and that's why we have that. So, and I mentioned last week that the evidence that the evolutionists have is not their evidence. It's all of our evidence. So when evolutionists say, well, this is what happened and here's our evidence that we show, we can use the same evidence and say, that's not what happened. This becomes more of a better explanation when we use the creation. People will ask about carbon 14 dating. And this fellow here is Norbert Libby. He's the one that won the Nobel Prize for his study in the carbon 14. And this is his quote. Recent elaborate studies have now demonstrated conclusively that the initial activity of C14 samples and thus the rate of C14 production has varied with time. You can't have that in radiometric dating. You can't have variation. You have to have a steady state all the way through from the time that this organism died that had the C14 in it. And it had to go over a long period of time, and it had to gradually release its C14 in order for you to know how old it was. Okay, now this is one of the assumptions. It says, secondly, it is assumed that the samples to be dated have not been contaminated since their death. Now that becomes a huge problem, because how do you keep these what were living organisms? How do you keep rain and snow and wind and all sorts of things from washing away the carbon 14 that was in the animal? And better yet, how do you keep from carbon 14 from leaching back into it? Anytime you have variation like that, you can't use that that method. So that the proportion of carbon 14 to carbon 12 has not been changed other than by the steady process of radioactive decay. He's saying it has to be gradual, and it has to be known and constant. And get this. This depends on the careful collection of samples by the archaeologists in the field. No, it doesn't. He could collect it as best as he can, but he can't change what happened between the time that the animal died and the time that he collects it. You got the rain and the weather and all sorts of things that could have an effect on that. So how he collects it has nothing to do with it. Radiocarbon dating is not only subject to errors, like all scientific procedures, it depends on definite assumptions. Folks, it's a philosophy. We're not talking about facts. And these must be understood if the method is to be used properly. Firstly, it is assumed that the radioactive decay of radiocarbon will take place in a regular way, quite unaffected by physical and chemical conditions such as temperature or contact with the air, and also that the decay rate is known. How do you do it?
Is that what they're talking about, like in Israel, they would say this is an official place because of the carbon?
Yes, that's the same. The question was whether this was what they use in Israel when they, yes. Okay. The third assumption, it's a small proportion of radiocarbon in all living things at a given time is in fact a constant, and that it does not vary from place to place or among different species. It too is found in practice to be broadly justified. Again, an assumption, it's not a fact. And they don't know what the carbon was at the beginning that the animal had. Finally, it is assumed that the concentration of radiocarbon in the Earth's atmosphere has remained constant through time. If this is so, see, they don't know. By measuring the proportion of radiocarbon present in living things today, we can obtain a valid value for the proportion that the sample contained when it was alive. No, there's way too many variables for them to say that. For dating purposes, the sample must be virtually unaffected by weathering or post-depositional chemical alterations. Show me anything out there that's not been affected by rain or wind or snow, heat. In an effort to evaluate a discordant age, it's one that they don't agree, sequence, therefore the data are adjusted in one of several ways until the lead-uranium or the lead-lead ages are in agreement. If they don't like the results that they get, then they change it so that it meets what their expectations are. That's not science, folks. Okay, what are these discordant dates? What they do is when they check something out for radiocarbon dating, they get a number. If it's the number that they want, they keep it. If it's not the number that they want, they discard it and they don't want you to know what they are. I had a friend that had some things radiocarbon dated, and he took it in to have it dated. And the first question they asked him was, well, how old do you think that it is? And they wouldn't do it until he gave them the number that what he expected it to be. Okay, now we have living mollusks, snails, so on, have had their shells dated by C14 up to 2,300 years. Now these are living, these guys are living, and it's 2,300 years old. New wood from actively growing trees has been dated by the same method 10,000 years. Freshly killed seals have been dated 1,300 years, and mummified seals, dead no longer than 30 years, have been dated up to 4,600 years. Okay? In general, dates in the correct ballpark are assumed to be correct and are published, but those in disagreement with other data are seldom published, nor are discrepancies fully explained. Okay, mutations. We hear a lot about that. Things mutate over a period of time, and that's how we get to some of the animals that we have today. And so, anyway, let's look at mutations. Mutations. They do not add any new genetic material to the animal. All it does is just change its location in the genome. For any acceptable theory of the mechanism of evolution, a great number of fully viable hereditary variations is necessary. Mutations does produce hereditary changes, but the mass evidence shows that all, if or almost all, mutations are unmistakably pathological, and few remaining ones are highly suspect. Take these fruit flies, which we learned when we were in biology, and you bombard them with radioactive material, gamma rays, alpha waves, and you'll scramble the genetic material. You won't add to it, but you'll change the organism so that maybe they don't have wings, or they can't fly, or whatever, shriveled wings, all sorts of different things. It's still a fruit fly. And notice here, pathological. That means when they bombard this, most of them die. Dead things don't evolve. The fruit fly has long been the favorite object of mutation experiments because of its fast gestation period, about 12 days. X-rays have been used to increase the mutation rate of the fruit fly by 15,000%. All in all, scientists have been able to catalyze the fruit fly evolutionary process such that what has been seen to occur in the Drosophila, the fruit fly, is the equivalent of many millions of years of normal mutations and evolution. Even with the tremendous speed up of mutations, scientists have never been able to come up with anything other than a fruit fly. Points to ponder. Now, this is in your notes. I thought about this last night. I thought this might be something that might tickle us a little bit. We've been told the skin cancer rate is greatly increased with continued exposure to the sun. If mutations were necessary to cause things to become more advanced, why aren't the scientists willing to expose themselves to the sun's radiation? Why don't we see more advanced forms of life, including man, coming from the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Why are we told how bad this was to the Japanese when, if mutations were necessary to increase new and better life forms, it should be considered a good thing? Why weren't scientists flocking in droves to Three Mile Island in Chernobyl? Why wouldn't they want to be first in line to be a higher life form? Because they know. They know that mutations are not good. Okay, another icon of evolution that's used in the biology books is the Darwin finches. Now, these are the ones that he observed on the Galapagos Islands back in the 1800s. And he saw these birds, and they had different shaped beaks. And he just thought, well, if we have different shaped beaks and everything, then these have evolved from one into another. Well, that's not true. It's just adaptation. These guys all have the same genetic material. If you see somebody out there that is a different ethnicity than you are, they have the same genetic material that you do. It's only that the genes are expressed in a different way. Some of you have brown eyes. Some of you have blue eyes. You've all got the same genetic material. It's just expressed differently. It's what happens with the birds. They will adapt in different climates. When the climate changed, Darwin noticed that the beaks changed also. That's just adaptation. Now, we talked about this a little bit last week, and I kind of skipped over it. But this is what the evolutionists use to make their claim of going from spontaneous generation all the way down to the life forms. And I thought it would be important to put this in here again because it's going to have a big support on our next slide. But these are the seven basic assumptions that are often not mentioned in discussions of evolution. Many evolutionists ignore the first six assumptions and consider only the seventh. So they'll say this, number one, is that non-living things gave rise to living material, and we learned that that isn't true. We talked about spontaneous generation last week. We talked about the Miller-Urey experiment. Okay, it doesn't work. It's just not true. The second assumption is that the spontaneous generation occurred only once. Well, my question is, if that happened that long ago, how do the scientists know that it only happened one time? They don't know. They say this because this first one is such a improbability or an impossibility. They dare not say, oh, we're going to duplicate that and let it have it more than once. Okay. The third assumption is that viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are all related. I don't know how they come up with that. The fourth assumption is that protozoa, single-cell life forms, gave rise to metazoa, multiple life forms. I heard a doctor on the media, and he was talking about, okay, we have single-cell life forms, such as yeast and bacteria and so on. But we never had, and those are one cell. We don't have two. There are none out there that are two. There are none of that out there that are three or four. You jump from a single cell all the way to millions of cells. The fifth assumption is that various invertebrate phyla are interrelated, meaning that the ones that don't have backbones, those are the invertebrates, those that don't have backbones, those are all related. That's an assumption. It's not a fact. And the sixth assumption is that invertebrates gave rise to vertebrates, those with backbones. And then the last one that they give is that the invertebrates, the fish, gave rise to the birds and reptiles and so on. Okay, now this next one is homologous limbs. Evolutionists and what we saw in our biology books when we were in high school is that their assumption is that all animals are related. They're going to say that all of these are similar because they're related. Human, horse, cat, bat, bird, and whale. They'll say that because they're related, they have similar forms. Well, I look at it from the same evidence, remember? I've got the same evidence that they do. I look at that and I say, no. The only reason why it's like that is because we have a creator that created things similarly. See, he had his own mind that he had a pattern that he wanted to go after, and that's what he used. So when you start out with the wrong assumption that evolution is true, you can make anything fit what you want it to be. Okay, but they can't fool us because we've got the same evidence that they do, and we can use that also. Now, to put it similarly, if we were all to walk out into the parking lot, we'd see a bunch of cars. And we'd see a car and we'd say, oh, that car must have given rise to that car because it has four wheels, it has a steering wheel, has a speedometer, has an engine. So that car must have evolved over into this one. That's true. I'm just going to, instead of getting a new car, I'll just let mine sit in the garage until I get a new car. We know that's silly, but that's what they believe. Okay, now this is from a creationist. This comes from Henry Morris. And he's poking fun at the evolutionists. He says, unknown chemicals, that's when we talked about the Miller-Urey experiment last week. Unknown chemicals in a primordial past through unknown processes which no longer exist produced unknown life forms which are not to be found, but could, through unknown reproductive methods, spawn new life in an unknown atmospheric composition, in an unknown oceanic soup complex, in an unknown time and place. Folks, we don't have enough faith to be an evolutionist. All right? Now, the next I think that concludes the evidences that the evolutionists use to support their theory. It's a theory. It's not a fact. You'll hear them say it's a fact. You'll be made fun of because you're telling them it's not a fact. It's only a theory. Let's move on to the next one. We have a few minutes. Now, I will tell you that Pastor Monty gave me 2 weeks to do this, and I usually take 12 to 16 weeks to teach this material. So I'm not going to get it done, I can tell you that. But I'm trying to give you some of the highlights of the stuff that I teach. But we're going to move on. You say, well, that's what the evolutionists believe. What do we as Christians have to support other than what the Bible tells us? What do we have out there? What kind of evidence, when we look at what God has created, when we see the Grand Canyon, how can we say, well, that didn't happen through millions of years with the Colorado River cutting it out. So how do we look at it as Christians? How do we look at all the other evidences that are out there from a creationist set of lenses? How can we use that? So we're going to go on to the next one here. It's going to be on probably about the fourth or fifth page. And I won't have slides for this, but like I said, when the notes are posted online, you'll be able to look at these notes and you can click on these hyperlinks, and you can go, and it'll take you right to Answers in Genesis, and you can read much more than what I'm going to talk about now. So we know that there's very little sediment on the ocean floor. We can measure that, okay? And we can measure the amount of sediment that's going into the oceans from all the continents. So based upon that, we know how deep it is, and we know how fast it's going in, then we ought to be able to back calculate and use that to determine how long it would take for that amount of sediment to get there. So we have every year 10 billions of tons of earth and rock and so on going into the ocean, and only 1 billion tons are removed by tectonic plates. Tectonic plates are the land masses both above the ground and below the ground, and they shift a little bit each year. So if they shift a little bit, then some of that will go down into the plates and go deeper, and you're going to get a little bit of loss there. But only 1 billion tons are removed by the tectonic plates. At this rate, current thickness of the seafloor sediment would accumulate in less than 12 million years. Well, they're telling us that the world is billions of years old. It's a big difference. Such sediments are easily explained by water draining off of the continents towards the end of the flood. So, by looking at it from a creationist perspective, we're looking at the water draining the sediment going into the oceans, and you're getting the buildup as a result of the water coming off of the land and into the ocean after the flood. I don't think I'm going to be able to get to the next one right away, so we're going to pick this up again. Whether Pastor Monty will let me have more time next week, when he gets back, I'll talk to him. If he wants to continue on with the material that he has, it's his class, so he can do what he wants. But he did say before he left on vacation that there will be times when he's going to be out of town, and we can pick this up. So hang on to your notes, and then when Jay gets the notes posted online, you can go out and use those hyperlinks that I created for resource material, and you can read up more on some of the things that I have posted there. All righty, we'll pick up next time. Thank you.